Chapter 14, Eddie Murphy and Me. My infamous run-in with Eddie Murphy has been discussed and repeated so many times over the years by so many people that I'm sort of done with it. But I feel like I should say it out loud one final time just to sort of put a bow on it and move on. Tidy little bow. That way when the aliens come down looking for some mildly amusing anecdotes to take back to their planet when they blow ours to smithereens, this one will be primed and ready to go. When I finally came up with that Hollywood Minute sketch, as previously recounted in great and excruciatingly boring detail, it was a huge relief to me. I needed something to stick. Things were so dire for me that whenever I saw Adam Sandler in his office tuning his guitar, I'd just crumple up whatever I was writing, go out for pizza, and stick a gun in my mouth between bites because he would always kill. The first joke I used on Hollywood Minute went along with a photo of Michael Bolton. I think the line was, "Hey, Michael Bolton, your hair's really long in the back, but guess what? We all know what's happening on top. It's called Rogaine. Look into it." And then came, "I know you've sold 8 million albums, but guess what? I don't know anybody that has one." Laughs all around. I did the min, gross term for it, which I never actually called it, again 2 weeks later, and then as often as I could, despite everyone probably rolling their eyes whenever I brought it to the read-through table. The bit was working, and now the cast and other writers were always baiting me, daring me to go after certain people. Jim Downey was notorious for egging me on, because I was easily swayed by him because he was my boss, and he's a great writer, and I'm desperate to impress him in any way I could, because I'm sad, barf, I need attention, throw up. As time went on, I hit some peeps pretty hard, but I feel like I only did it if I felt they deserved it. It's a fine line between clever and just mean. I did cross it a few times, but I went for laughs. Some of my favorite jokes back then were ripping on downtown Julie Brown after she had left MTV. Wubba, 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 my career's in trubba, trubba, trubba. MC Hammer was funny. Doo-doo-doo-doo, doo-doo, doo-doo, it's over. I actually went for Jim Carrey once, and I can say it was too soon. People loved him too much. I loved him too, frankly, but this was a case of writers egging me on, daring me to go after him. I did the joke at dress rehearsal, and it got so many hisses that I had to pull it. I liked it, though. I think it was, Jim Carrey was hospitalized this week on the set of his new movie after mixing over-the-top pills with play-it-too-big juice. It can be a deadly combo. He's fine now and quietly overacting at home. A lot of the times I had to go after friends, friends who happened to be in the news, so I felt like it was an omission if I skipped the story, and that's always a weird spot. But in the case of Jim Carrey, I was glad that joke didn't make it to air. Now comes infamous Eddie Murphy, Hollywood Minute. Here's the story as I remember it. After this, I swear I'm never talking about this again. Of course, I will, maybe 1 million more times. One week, I was writing my dopey little Hollywood Minute, my bread and butter, and basically the only thing keep me from going back on the road and doing shows at the Gutbusters in Omaha or working at the skate workshop. I was sort of addicted to doing them because it was the only thing keeping me in front of the camera and keeping my job safe. So I'm sitting in my dumpy office, and I realized that Eddie Murphy had put out 2 back-to-back flops. By the way, there couldn't be a harsher word to hit your ear when you're an actor than flop. It's brutal. Short, harsh, and to the point. Past tense is even worse. "Hey, I heard your movie fucking flopped." It's so awful, and I should know I've heard it a lot. That and bombed. I hate flop more, but your movie bombed. I think the 2 films he did that bombed were Harlem Nights and Vampire in Brooklyn. So I casually write a joke about Eddie Murphy for my piece that week. I think it was, "Look, kids, a falling star. Quick, make a wish." Anyway, the burn skims by on air, gets sort of a laugh, mixed in with an "no you didn't" response. I think nothing of it, especially because it's buried in the middle of like 10 or 12 of these rapid-fire sizzles that come and go very quickly. Pretty soon it's over, I move on and start drinking my Amstel Light. Getting ready for the good nights. Ooh, which way should I wave? That was my big problem that night. Who should I hug at the end, Adam or Chris? So on the following Monday at around 5 p.m., I was sitting in the writer's room, reading the paper, waiting for the meeting with this week's host, when an NBC page came in the room. He looked at me a little oddly and said, Eddie Murphy's on the phone for you? My heart stopped. What the fuck? Seriously? I squeaked. Yeah, line 2. I'm not here. Take a message. She walked away. I could tell she was a bit starstruck by him, not me, and curious as to why Eddie was calling me. Also curious as to why I wasn't sprinting to the phone. Meanwhile, I was quietly shitting diarrhea into my Dockers, out the window, and down 6th Avenue thinking, holy shit, why is this famous motherfucker calling me? My spider senses are tingling. Something's wrong. He has to be pissed. What do I say? I did that joke about him. Oh my God. That has to be it. In other words, I was freaking the fuck out. I didn't know if I should call him back, or act like I didn't know he had called, or hide under Lauren's desk till this crazy storm blew over. I was starting to have an actual official panic attack when ring. The phone 7 feet from me in the writer's room started ringing. One of the assistants picked it up. Writer's room. Hang on. David, it's Eddie Murphy. Can't find me, I say casually, staring a hole through People magazine, pretending to read it. Frozen in total unmitigated fear. By now, my heartbeat has picked up the pace a little bit. The guy hangs up. I break out of my trance and I realize I need to enlist Chris Rock. He covers all bases. He's my black friend, so any black-related problems go across his desk. He gets CC'd on everything. And he's Eddie's buddy, so he knows what I'm dealing with. He will have special insight. It's like when a movie brings in a real forensic criminologist to be a consultant. Rock knows what makes this guy tick. He can solve this. But before I can even get up to find Rock, I have another problem. Ring. God damn it, he's calling again. What the fuck? Eddie Murphy again, the page said. I'm in a meeting, I lied. He says he knows you're not in a meeting because it's 5:45 and the Monday host meeting's at 6 and it's never on time. He says call him back right now or he's driving in from Brooklyn to talk to you in person. Woo, I'm staring in disbelief. Why on God's green earth is this superstar blowing me up 3 times in a row? Didn't he have money to count or chicks to bang? One day, 20 years later, someone had this very thought about me. Success! Chris Rock then walked in and said, you better call him. You don't want him coming down here. Don't forget, Spade, he's still a black guy. No shit. I don't want this guy coming down to talk to me. Even if he's famous, he scares me. I have no choice, so I take his number and ask Chris to get on the other phone to listen in and protect me somehow. I dial, beep, boop, boop, beep, beep, beep. My heart's pounding. I did not want to do this, especially since I have zero game plan. Zero. Hello? A woman's voice answered. My heart left. Perhaps I'd dialed the wrong number, hopefully. Is Eddie there? It's David Spade. I'm sure my voice cracked like Peter Brady in that Brady Bunch episode where he goes through puberty. Hang on, she said. Then it was muffled in here. It's him. My stomach in knots. I hear, hello?
Hey, Eddie. Dave Spade, how are ya?
Dramatic pause. If this was a Lifetime movie, we would definitely fade into a commercial at this point. Now here comes Eddie. David Spade, who the fuck do you think you are? Honestly, who the fuck? Going after me? You dumb motherfucker? I'm off limits, don't you know that? You wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for me. You're talking shit about me? Etc., etc., exclamation point, etc. On, making me feel like shit. I barely spoke. I was staring at Rock in disbelief. This was so much worse than I imagined. I think I was trying to apologize. I couldn't get anything out. I was like, sorry, Nothing came out. Here's one of my favorite comedians of all time, ripping me a new asshole. I had worshipped this dude for years. I knew every line of his stand-up. Now he hated me. Like, really, really hated me. Like, the opposite of Sally Field. This was horrible. I didn't hate him. Of course not. He just got caught in some friendly fire and my deep desire to make an impression on my bosses and keep my job. How pathetic. I took my beating and then he hung up. I felt like Adrian Peterson's kid. Rock felt bad for me. He was caught in the middle. Old friend of Eddie's, new friend of mine. I said, Rock, Eddie makes fun of Mr. T getting AIDS and a million other people on his HBO special. This joke was barely a flesh wound. It won't hurt him. What the fuck is he freaking out about? I'm a nobody. Rock tried to make me feel better. Nothing he could do. He split back to his office. I kept thinking it wasn't fair. But the truth was that when you're famous, you never want someone on a supposedly cool show to say you're not cool. Even if that person saying it is a nobody like me. Fame is so fragile and fleeting, it can disappear for a million reasons. A jab like the one I direct to Eddie can be the one thing that starts to turn public opinion against you. I try not to think of the casualties when I do those rough jokes, but there are consequences sometimes. I know for a fact I can't take it when it comes my way. It is horrible, and all for the same reasons. I've come to see Eddie's point on this one. Everyone in showbiz wants people to like them. That's how you get fans. And when you get reamed in a sketch or online or however, that shit stings, and it can add up quickly. Then before you know it, you're a punchline. Just look at Vanilla Ice or a million others. Eddie was mad. No one had dared go after him, and he wanted to stop fucking right there. He did not want this catching on. After that incident, I had some close encounters with Mr. Murphy. Once I was at the opening of the Hard Rock Hotel in Vegas, when a bunch of celebs got invited to see a private Rolling Stones concert. What a douche thing for me to mention in the book, but yeah, you heard it, and I did it. I brought one of my idiot buddies from high school there. This place was fucking star-studded event. Brad Pitt to my right, Depp and DiCaprio at noon and six. There couldn't have been more celebs in there. We were packed in like sardines. L-O-L-O-L. Sardines, not sardines. You heard it right. Stay close. I was having the time of my life when for some reason I glanced at the row behind me. I think it was just to let those people know that I knew all the words to Gimme Shelter. When who do I see down the row but Edward Murphy and Chris Rock? Oh, fuck. My kryptonite was in the house. Suddenly feeling weak. I didn't want to get beat up in front of the Stones. It was going to be Altamont all over again. So I snuck another glance and saw Rock mouth to me, "I can't talk to you. I'm with Eddie." I understood. Rock was a chicken shit. I'm kidding. I was never mad at Rock because he was always half kidding. But I was freaking out enough where Brad Pitt noticed. And he asked what's going on, so I fill him in on the short version of the story, not the long one that you're getting. He goes, "Oh, I'll protect you. You know, like I'm a chick," which I am, sort of. So I laughed quietly and hoped he was serious. Whenever I see Rock after that for years, he'd go, "I saw Eddie last week. He still hates you." It sort of impressed me that it still bugged him. In a recent Rolling Stone cover story, Eddie Murphy was asked about this stupid incident. I was told that he said he was mad at everyone about this, not just me. He was mad that Lauren let the joke to the air. He was mad that the show turned on him. And that's why he never hosted or did a reunion show. After this article came out, he briefly appeared at the 40th one, though. He said this is over now, and I hope that's true. About a month after that cover story, I was crossing the street in Beverly Hills, and I saw a Mercedes Gullwing, which is a super nice car, parked in front of Coffee Bean. Black guy walked out with his hot blonde chick on his arm and got in the car. Like the jerk that I am, I was like, "Oh, who does that guy play for?" Then as he started to pull out of the parking lot, I realized, oh my God, it's Ed Murphy. My old school fear came crashing back. Should I say something to this dude? We hadn't spoken in 20 years since our fun phone call. Before I knew it, Murphy had spotted me through the windshield. Maybe he thought I was Miley Cyrus. Either way, for some reason, I gave him a half wave and a quick nod. It was my equivalent of the white flag. This can be a risky move if it goes unreciprocated. Then I heard the sound of a window going down. Once again, I was paralyzed by doubt. Do I look? I look. He stopped in the middle of the street and I walked over. Through the open passenger window and over his chick, he said, "Hey, Spade, how you doing?" I reached in over his chick and shook his hand. "Hey, Eddie, glad we're good." "Take it easy," he said. Then he drove away with a girl young enough to be, well, my date. My Watergate with Eddie Murphy was over. The burden was lifted. After all those years, that stupid joke can be just that, a stupid joke. And I can go back to appreciating what a funny motherfucker he is. Chapter 15, Tommy Boy. Tommy Boy is the movie people ask me about the most. I've probably been in 20-something movies at this point, and like every actor, I have my favorites, and the ones I knew were clankers. Most actors can tell you the list of their top movies off the top of their heads in order because of the feedback they get. I hear positive comments about a handful of movies I've done, and I don't hear jack shit about the rest. Over the years, the top five have varied to some degree, obviously, but the clankers have never changed. Social media made it super obvious which of your movies your fans like. Lately, the top three have been Tommy Boy, Joe Dirt, and Grown Ups. There's certainly a fondness out there for Emperor's New Groove, which happens to be the only movie where I got good reviews. Of course, I was only a voice in the cartoon, but I'll take it! I'm still clinging to these positive notices. I also hear nice comments from time to time about Black Sheep, Benchwarmers, Dickie Roberts. But Tommy Boy is the one that's most loved from people of all ages all over the map. Which is nice because of all the things I've done, this movie's the one I'm most proud of. I love being on the TV shows, but if we're talking about films, they're a whole different animal. With Tommy Boy, I'm just amazed that it came together as well as it did. At the time, it felt completely thrown together, and that was part of the fun. I was actually very lucky to be part of this movie. I was still on Saturday Night Live and by no means killing it, but Chris was totally killing it. Lorne Michaels, in his infinite wisdom, liked the way we interacted around the office and had a notion to do something with it. We were always hanging out, ripping into each other. I'd make fun of Chris and he'd laugh, and everything he did made me laugh. Chris was actually much sharper than most people thought. You could throw any joke at him, no matter how dry or far-fetched, and he would get it right away and start laughing. Or better yet, add to it and throw it back. A lot of people thought he was super dumb, but most of that was just an act he did to come across as funny, and it always worked, but with the comedy, he was very smart. So sometime around 1993, Lorne reached out to Bonnie and Terry Turner, the awesome husband and wife writing team that went on to create The 70s Show and Third Rock from the Sun. They were writers on SNL. Lorne said, "I have a deal to make some movies for Paramount. Why don't you guys write something for David and Chris, the way they act around The Office? Use that relationship, make some sort of big comedy." So Bonnie and Terry went off and came up with a movie about Chris and me as traveling salesmen driving through Ohio selling brake pads. They put a rough draft of the script together pretty quickly. At that point, they called it Billy the Third, a Midwestern, which I thought was clever. The whole movie was a gift, especially to me, because at this point in his career, Farley probably could carry a movie on his own, even though that was still the early days for him. But this script was ready to go with an idea that Paramount liked, and it included me. We just had to have the script ready in time to shoot for the summer during our time off from the show. Now, this was great news because I don't think we could ever have been able to sell that movie on a pitch alone. I know that. We backed into the whole thing because of Lorne's deal with Paramount and its then CEO, Sherry Lansing. Sherry approved the movie based on the cast, and thank God for that. If she had just heard the pitch, if we walked in there and said, "Here's a movie about two bozos that drive around selling brake pads in Ohio," you know, it doesn't exactly sound like the next Star Wars. So we got lucky that we skated right past that based on our amazing marquee names. Chris's, anyway. So Chris and I read the script. We agreed it was a bit rough, but good. Fred Wolf was brought into a rewrite, nail our voices a little better. Fred, Chris, and I were buddies, so this was perfect. He eventually became the head writer of SNL. Luckily for me, he knew my voice really well and the types of jokes I liked to do. Everyone was on board and happy. We had one tiny stumbling block, which was that Adam was about to come out with Billy Madison. We all decided that both Adam and Chris being named Billy in their first movie was not smart. So Billy the Third was scrapped. However, it was a lot harder than we thought to come up with a new title. We played with Rocky Road for a while. Then it was Big Time. Nothing seemed exactly right. Finally, someone said Tommy Boy at the end of the shooting and it stuck. It's funny because I didn't really like that name, and now that I look back, I can't think of it being anything else, of course. Fred worked on the script with feedback from Chris and me. It took longer than it should have because we didn't start shooting until the beginning of August, right before we had to report back to New York for SNL. This situation ended up becoming a bit prickly. We were shooting in Toronto, and the idea was that we'd be on a little private plane, like a Lear 55. It would take Farley and me back and forth once the show started. I think we got 2 straight weeks of shooting before the back and forth started. What a grind. Our schedule became Monday, Tuesday, Toronto. Wednesday, fly to New York, do the read-through. Thursday, Toronto. Friday, Saturday, back to New York for the show. And then at 1:30 a.m. Sunday, after the show Saturday, plane would take us back to Toronto and shoot Sunday morning at 7 a.m. Now, this scared the Spade man a little bit, because I am what's commonly known around the schoolyard as a pussy. My neck gives me trouble for my little extravaganza faceplant way back when. I need to eat all the time. Blah, blah, blah. The list goes on and on. It's what doctors call high maintenance. I'm good for only one thing, and that's throwaway jokes in a movie like Tommy Boy. So the plan was shove some Vicodins in my pocket, a protein bar down my throat, push me out there, and then say some funny shit, you little clown. Chris came with his own list of challenges, in quotes. If memory serves, he was not drinking at this point, which is a gift. He was in the middle of a sober stint. This was a recipe for more moodiness than normal with him. And then, well, he liked his food. Loved his food. Any food. All the time. He switched his addiction from booze to caffeine to get through this schedule. By the end of the movie, I lost weight and he gained weight, so the pounds were still on the screen. We just switched him from me to him. The first day of shooting was the first time either of us had played the lead in a film when we were trying to prep for the overwhelmingness to come. We never had to memorize lines for Saturday Night Live because they were always changing and would ultimately be on cue cards anyway. Pete Siegel, our director on Tommy Boy, was a very easygoing, affable guy who loved comedy. He was a very good presence to have on the set because he wasn't a screaming asshole, which I found out later some directors are. He sometimes didn't 100% get our weird sense of humor, but he liked us and told us be as funny as we could, riff, make shit up. He'd make it work, make it look good, and make sure the story worked. And he did do all that. Day one involved 3.5 pages of dialogue between just Chris and me in a diner. During the conversation, I realized that Chris, Tommy, is a good salesman. Simple enough, right? Being a comedian, I was used to getting one shot to get something right. Of course, SNL, you put your stuff up live, so that's only one take also. Neither of us were prepared for how many takes we would have to do to knock out a 3.5-page scene. It was 12 straight hours of saying the same shit over and over, trying to keep it lively and loose because you never know which take they're going to use. Pete did at least 15 master shots of the two of us. 10 over the shoulder towards Chris, 10 medium close-ups, 10 tight close-ups. Then he flipped around. We did 10 to 15 from a bunch of different angles, blah, 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 all day. Pete called it coverage. We called it smotherage. Chris and I did not foresee the burnout that would come with all this. It was super amateur hour for us in the movie thing. We were very naive. Here's an example of how green we were. In the morning, Chris started his day with a thermos of cappuccino. I don't drink coffee, so I knew cappuccino was stronger than coffee, so I just watched this unfold. He would do a small shot before each take to make sure he gave it everything. After literally 26 shots, I go, dude, you can't do this shit anymore. Pete just told me, we're doing this all day. We haven't gotten to our close-ups. Save it. Chris would go into his trailer at lunch and crash hard. No PAs ever wanted the task of waking him up because they learned pretty quickly that they would get their heads ripped off, which of course was hilarious to me, except when I was on the other end of it. In fact, Chris would get so mad when someone woke him up in such a predictable fashion that I couldn't resist the chance to set him up. Midway through the shoot, Sherry Lansing stopped by the set to say hello. She chatted with me at lunch for a minute, and then she said she'd like to say hi to Chris before she left. This was a typical set visit, but having the visitor be the head of the studio wasn't so typical. It's usually an executive who stops by, not the big cheese. I should have told Sherry that Chris was sleeping, but instead told her, he's in his trailer. I'll have a PA walk you over there. He'd love to chat with you. As she was getting closer to the trailer, everyone started looking around with a worried look going, this is not going to end well. Well, Sherry Lansing, the head of Paramount, the one who greenlit our movie and was responsible for our checks, tapped on the door of his trailer. Chris, are you in there? And here comes the response we all expected. I said I'm sleeping and don't wake me up, you fucking cunt! Sherry didn't even react. She just quietly goes, Chris, it's Sherry Lansing. I just wanted to say hi. Pause. Then a completely different sweet Chris voice comes out. Oh, hey, Sherry! Let me get something on! What a treat! Okay, it'll be one sec. The very next day, we shot the scene where I come to Tommy Boy's hotel in the morning with coffee to announce that we had just made a sale. I knock on the door and I go, housekeeping? In a high-pitched Spanish voice. This was something we added to the script when we shot it because I said that to Chris every day at the hotel where we were staying. We stayed on the same floor at the Four Seasons in Toronto the whole shoot. We had a 5 a.m. pickup. I would go over to Chris's room and knock on the door and I'd go, housekeeping? And he would go, no thanks. And I would do it over and over, saying all the things that maids say when they come to your door. You want me to check minibar? You need towel? You like chocolate mouse? On and on until he'd go, get the fuck out of here. It says do not disturb, you fucking bitch. Look at the thing on the door. And then he'd open up the door and see me and go, oh, it's you. And I go, yes, Chris, it's me. Every fucking time. I can't believe you still fall for this. Shut up. So when we shot the hotel scene, we threw this exchange in just to make something funnier out of a flatter scene with our stupid daily shenanigans. That was usually the drill. We also couldn't figure out what Farley should wear when he opened the door in that scene. I was pushing for him to come up to the door wrapped in nothing but a blanket, and then he would drop it when he said his last line. Oh, Richard, don't run from your feelings. We ended up doing three versions. mostly for ratings problems. One where he had pajama bottoms, one where he's wearing little tidy whities with polka dots, and one where he's totally naked, just for the gag reel. When we did the one where he's totally naked, everyone busted up laughing. He was being shot from behind, but for some reason he turned around to the camera and started moving his hips and swinging his dick around in circles and goes, "Sherry, do you like the movie?" or something about Sherry. So ridiculous. Everyone laughed harder because everyone was now in fear of getting fired. I recently saw those dailies just to prove that this story, one in my book, actually really happened. I always wondered if Pete stopped that take from getting to Paramount, because the studio folks went through dailies every night to see how the shoot was going. That swinging dick might not have sent a positive message. Who knows? Sherry was so cool, she probably wouldn't have given a shit. She probably saw it. As the shoot dragged on, it got harder and harder to keep our spirits up. Chris and I were great friends, of course, and we were having a fucking blast, cracking each other up. There was little downtime, and the moodiness and irritability set in. It was just human nature. Being together 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it got tough. I always said we're like a married couple, except we sleep in the same bed. By the way, it was so pointless for me to fly back to New York for read-through on Wednesdays, because if I didn't write something for myself, I wasn't going to be in the show. And I was too burned out from memorizing lines and shooting to write anything. So by flying back to read-through, I was getting the shit kicked out of me from exhaustion with a sprinkle of humiliation. Chris always had a lot to do in read-through. Writers could put him in every sketch because they knew he was a score machine, but he was wiped out too. A lot of things come together from different angles when you're doing a comedy. Every joke is so fucking important that you rack your brain all day to make things better and better. The best jokes are almost never in the script that was handed to you that day. I would imagine that in a drama you don't have much leeway. I don't know for sure, Lifetime's never called me. But with comedy, especially if you have a good enough team of actors, directors, producers, you can just keep adding to the bitter end to make the movie funnier. I know Apatow, Will Ferrell, Sandler, all the funniest guys out there do that. Even an editor who's on his game can get you some free laughs. A good editor is so important. Our guy Bill Kerr was always great at the extra gag. A few days after we shot the scene in the gas station where Farley breaks the doors off, Kerr showed me a rough version. He had done it so the scene cuts to me being sarcastic to the attendant, and then back to the attendant, and then back to me again before we say another line. Stuff like that is so crucial in the final product. We got three laughs instead of one. He also threw in the song Crazy, droning on in the background. Another nice touch. All this eventually stayed in the movie. One of my script ideas was in the scene where Chris and I are driving after a long day of sales. We're both burned out and tired, and a really fruity song comes on the radio. I pitched this idea to Fred on his phone machine that the song should be one by the Carpenters. This comes from my real life because I had the best of the Carpenters CD in my car because I loved it. And one time a girl got in and turned it on, and Rainy Days and Mondays was blaring. And I was like, what is this shit? What did you turn on? Is that yours? I acted like I didn't know it was even in there. I tried to blame her. It was stupid. So the scene in the movie is based on that, and it's pretty funny, especially with the final beat of the hood of the car popping up and we spin out. That one is joke to joke to joke. And Fred was good at placing ideas like that, then adding on to them. One other bit we threw in at the last minute was the scene right before I whack off to the girl at the pool. It was sort of flat and mostly just story, so I asked if we could weave in a bit I'd written for Weekend Update a few weeks before. I was still trying in my lame way to get on the show. The bit involved me reviewing movies, and I'd show like a picture of Cameron Diaz and go, you know what, I like this movie? Buddy, whack it. And then I'd show Jessica Alba, you know what team loves this Jessica Alba movie? The Yankees. Who's your favorite little rascal? Was it Spanky? It was all whack-off jokes, on and on. All these jokes were loaded into that update bit, which bombed at read-through, by the way, and I had high hopes for it. I had such confidence in this bit that I go, there's something funny about it. If we could just put it in somewhere else and maybe this scene and dish those payoff lines to Chris because it made the most sense. It's not a big scene and it's not hilarious, but it just makes something like that a little funnier. Also, when Chris walked by the hot girl at the pool and he goes, is there a weight room? Whatever he says, all those were classic Farley making up shit and killing on his feet. Props can also help a scene, too. I love the exchange when Chris tells me he's wearing a clip-on and I go, are you sure? Those throwaway jokes are important. They don't get huge laughs when you read a script, but they're nice texture and they carry the style of your humor across. Often they pass by so quickly it doesn't matter if not everyone laughs. Those are my favorite kind of jokes, the ones that you laugh at like the 10th time you see it, and you know the rest of the movie so well that you start picking up on those. As I say this, I feel like I'm patting myself on the back, claiming I wrote every joke in that movie. I did not, of course. I didn't write barely any. I would just add my ideas here and there and try to hold up my end of the deal. This movie was obviously a tour de force for Chris. It made him a huge star. He was great in it. Bonnie, Terry, and Fred wrote a great script. Fred added jokes. Pete added jokes. We all helped. Chris did his improv. The one thing I did do was rely on my memory. I could remember funny shit Chris said in the past. So I would tell him something he did 2 years ago. I go, maybe try this. And he go, oh, that's a great joke. Thanks. I go, no, that's your joke, dude. You said it 2 years ago on the way to dinner. So that would help. But that's not me. That's him. We finished the movie and Paramount seemed pretty happy with the test screenings. When it was released, it was number one for the weekend. That shocked a lot of people, including us. Neither of us had much concept whether we had fans or if anyone gave a fuck about us at all, especially outside of SNL. So to see the movie debut number one was a nice boost. All these years later, it's still kind of talked about in my circle, which I guess it means it stood the test of time, where many of my other on-screen performances, or gems as I call them, have not. I have to say that I definitely got spoiled with Tommy Boy because I didn't realize how fucking hard it was to get a movie to number one, to get it pretty solid all the way through and make it memorable 10 years later. People forget that making a shitty movie is just as hard as making a good one. You don't know it's going to be bad, really, until it comes out. That one was lightning in a bottle. After Tommy Boy worked, Chris and I went on to shoot Black Sheep. The story behind Black Sheep is complicated and there's a few different versions out there. I'm just going to tell you my version, how I remember it. Sometimes people remember it differently, but this is my recollection. Paramount wanted to do another movie with us after Tommy Boy. The timing needed to be that we would write the movie during the season and then shoot it in the summer again. It was interesting working backward from a green light. I don't think there's ever a time in my career when I experienced that. I can say now it was a great luxury. But the problem was that after Tommy Boy was considered a success, everything got way more complicated. That movie was Chris, Fred, me making up shit, having fun, no one on our asses. This movie was being watched like a hawk and the clock was ticking. Fred wrote up a quick version of the script and handed it to me, Chris, and Paramount to read. This is where things got tough. In a strange turn of events, I was going to make more money than Chris on this movie. The reason was that Chris had been in and out of rehab, and so he made a two-picture deal with Lorne and Paramount. I'm sure he signed it to get back in everyone's good graces or whatever and show he's a team player. But he had a set fee for the second movie. My fee for Tommy Boy was a one-shot deal, so I got to negotiate from scratch for the follow-up. So that was awkward, but we got past it because it didn't really matter. He made more than me in the first. The real elephant in the room was that Chris had quietly been offered the lead in Cable Guy for $3 million. This was an unbelievable amount of money and nothing close to what either of us was going to make for Black Sheep. So I came to work one day and Chris is there all hair greased back, smoking a cigarette. He was in all biz mode. He goes, hey, you read Black Sheep yet? And I go, no, I'm reading it tonight. How is it? He goes, it's good. It's not great. I think it needs a lot of work. There's some funny moments, but you know, we should take our time with this, get it right, probably wait till next summer. So I left him. I went to Obon Payne Cafe underneath Rockefeller Center. I went there to think about the situation and eat, because I always eat. Now, this was very unnerving. I knew that if I didn't like the script and said no to doing Black Sheep that summer, Chris would be off the hook with Paramount and he could do the Cable Guy. But if I liked the script and said yes, Chris would have to do it because he owed Paramount a movie. I had to take his script comments with a grain of salt because maybe he was telling me in between the lines, just say no to this one so he could do Cable Guy. I decided I would read it with an open mind and just go with my gut. If I didn't like it, we would wait a year. Chris could do whatever he wanted. So that night I read it and I realized it wasn't perfect, but there was a funny movie there. I thought we could work with Fred again, pepper in our jokes, and everything would be fine. This had a chance to be as good as Tommy Boy, in my opinion. So I said yes. That did not go over great. I told Chris, I'm sorry, but if you took Cable Guy out of the equation, I think you know this movie could be really good. He finally came around, but it was definitely uncomfortable for a second. Luckily, he faced reality and decided to focus on making this thing great. Our next problem we didn't see coming. To direct the movie, we wanted Pete and he couldn't do it. So Paramount hired Penelope Spheeris. She was a hot director coming off the success of her documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization, and then she did Wayne's World. Of course, that movie was a massive success, starred two SNL leads, so it all sounded perfect to everyone but Chris and me. Trouble started right away. Penelope told us right off the bat that she didn't really love Tommy Boy, and she knew how to make Chris and me funny. This is where someone should have yanked the plug. Then she ripped 40 pages out of the script and said she'd fix him with her writer. Fred had a few bad meetings with her, and he was essentially kicked off the project from then on. She was making so much more money than us that she outranked us. That was hard for us to deal with. I wish Pete had done it, but he was tied up. We all had the thing down. We could have made it a crusher. My gut told me Mike and Dana made all the comedy decisions on Wayne's World, but for some reason they were giving the credit to her. I didn't get it. In the movie, Chris and I shot a lot of scenes apart. This was odd because the whole point was we supposedly had chemistry. We were always funnier together. Chris also asked to make the relationship between him and his brother slightly more dramatic, which I didn't mind, but I personally thought the movie should be just straight comedy with as many jokes as we can cram in. I could tell she really thought Chris was a great talent. Unfortunately, I could also tell she thought I was not. But this was a package deal, and unfortunately for her, I was part of the package and she had to deal with it. The shoot went all right, but we had troubles along the way. It was not a good match. Once there was a dumb scene where I ran around singing Summer Lovin' from Grease. The idea was that I'd be out in the woods, singing at the top of my lungs, all the lines from there, when I'm caught by a bunch of tough hunters in the middle of the woods, scary deliverance guys. I would immediately switch gears and talk about how I wish I was blowing heads off antelopes with my trusty 12-gauge, blowing shit up, blah, blah, never acknowledging that I'd just been prancing around singing Summer Lovin', both the Sandy and Danny parts. This sounds sort of hacky and stupid, but 20 years ago, it probably would have worked. But this was definitely not funny to Penelope. At all. She kept telling me she didn't like this scene and she wanted it out. Fred, Chris, and I stood our ground, even Lauren. We said, let's shoot it, but we'll get rid of it if it doesn't test well. If it's not funny, nobody wants it in the fucking movie. We'll take it out. That seemed fair. So the day of that shoot, that scene, another one Chris wasn't in, we were 20 miles outside of LA in the middle of nowhere. We set up a crane shot to do the whole thing, just the master. I was waiting in my trailer. I was all by myself, waiting, waiting, waiting. Finally, Penelope knocks my door. She came in and shook her head. I can't do it. I'm not shooting it. I'm not putting the scene in my movie. I hate it. There was a pause while I went over the options in my head. I finally said, okay, got it. I guess that's a wrap. And we all went home. With no cell phone, no landline, and no way to get a hold of Lauren, there was nothing I could do. I had to eat this one. Penelope has said since then that I had never made her laugh. This makes a lot of sense to me. She couldn't say it out loud back then, because then she might get fired. I know my comedy isn't for everyone, but in my opinion, she just never should have taken that job. I was half that deal, and if she didn't like half of it, it was going to be a bumpy ride no matter what. Despite all that nonsense, the movie came out and still did pretty well. I liked a lot of it, and so did Chris. We by no means hated it, and there are still some fans that like that one even more than Tommy Boy. But if all the jokes and scenes that we came up with had been included, what that movie could have been when Chris was at the height of his popularity and on top of his game, that movie could have been unfucking believable. Here's a few more things about Chris. As you can tell, Chris Farley was a big part of my life for a small amount of time. After what happened to him, I got to chat with Danny Aykroyd about what happened with John Belushi. It was very nice to have a cool dude I looked up to let me open up and ask him questions about how to handle it all. I will always be remembered by many people, first and foremost, for the things I did with Chris, and I'm okay with that. Chris and I were so young and stupid on SNL when we made our movies together. We thought we had it all nailed. I think we can all agree that he did. I was still learning, and I was happy to be the straight guy, hanging out for dear life in that tornado that was Farley. But more than the comedy, it was the fact that Chris was my friend, and that was the important thing. Our screwing around and hanging out at SNL carried me through the times, and I wasn't exactly tearing it up on screen or in the writer's room. I could rely on him to make me laugh or laugh at my jokes when no one else would. I wanted to share one more story that perfectly represents the nature of our personalities and our stupid friendship. Not many people know this story, and I wish it was classier, but I'm just going to tell it anyway because it cracks me up. And if I don't, I'll get too emotional, so I have to keep it light. Once during our SNL stint, I had the amazing luck of dating a Playboy centerfold. Being the tool that I am, I had to puff up and bring the actual Playboy to work, bragging to all my friends that I was hooking up with this hot chick. I showed the pics to Chris, Adam, Chris Rock, the janitor, anyone that would look. I got a few high fives, some fist bumps way ahead of our time, and then we went to read-through. Well, during the read-through, Farrell sends me a crumpled-up note. There were no cell phones back then, ladies. And it said, "Did you look in our office yet?" And I look at him confused, and he smiled like that psycho Cheshire cat, and then nodded and giggled like, I was like, whatever, no, I haven't. And then at intermission, he asked again, and I go, no, what the fuck is in the office? And he just laughed and goes, you should look. Then he laughed a sinister laugh like in the Gap Girls. So I walked into my office with the others in tow, only to find the Playboy magazine open on my desk and the centerfold I was dating covered in jizz. Chris's jizz. Yes, folks, you heard me right. He hustled out a jack-off sesh right before the stressful read-through and was very proud of his work. He was right behind me when I walked in and saw it, as were Sandler and Rock. We were all a little shocked, even though we thought it was funny and gross and nuts. Chris looked around at all of us taking in our reactions. I could tell by the look in his face, he was suddenly worried he had gone too far, which made it funnier, because he had gone too far, which he did every time, and that's what made him Chris. And the fact that I was such a lame little shit, I had to bring the mag to work to brag to my buddies like a teenager. I deserved a good hazing. I'm not sure that's exactly the hazing I would have picked, but it was a great example of how out of the box he thought, aka borderline psycho. Chris always went right to the edge and often over it. Taking things too far is the thing that made him Chris, but it was also the thing that took him away at the end. I miss the guy every day. Chapter 16, Skippy. Hiring an assistant is a very difficult thing for people like me. Being an assistant to a celebrity, oh my God, did someone say I'm a celebrity? Is a vague job that everyone thinks is really easy because you seemingly need low to zero skills and zero schooling. Most people think it's a total cakewalk. One of the first questions I get from model actress types when they realize things aren't going perfectly as planned in LA and that they might need some steady income one day and they don't want to be hookers yet is, hey, do you know anybody that needs an assistant? They're like, what do? Just pick up dry cleaning, gas up cars, fly to New York on a private jet and hang backstage at Letterman, hit premieres and fuck off the rest of the time? I think I can handle that. This was the first type of assistant I had when I first got one. So there's a reason people think that, because that is a certain percentage of the people's job. Some assistant's job is just bone the guy. That's the one job I've never had, and I've never hired one. My first assistant was an old friend of mine, so she just hung out and shot the shit with me, did what she wanted, when she wanted, because I'm a softy. I never yell, and I'm easy to work with. Naturally, they take advantage of that. I tell her to come over at 10. She'd roll in at 10:45 with Starbucks going, the fucking 405 was nuts. I would sit there thinking, well, is this new information? No one ever says, hey, if you want to save time, take the 405. Best kept secret in LA. Shh, quiet. The 405 is nuts every day. Then she said something to the effect of, I can usually make it in 20 minutes if there's no traffic. Well, when's that? Christmas Eve? Any other time, it's fucked. Never say if there's no traffic. That's not a real scenario in LA. When that one left to have a baby with her boyfriend, I had to hire a new assistant. This time around, I interviewed a guy and a girl. The guy I knew already, his name was Skippy. That was his nickname. His real name was David, but I had dibs on David, so we went with Skippy to keep confusion down to a minimum. While I was deciding between Skippy and the chick, I got the unforgettable call that Chris had been found dead. Since Skippy had worked for the director of Tommy Boy, and that's how we met, he knew Chris, he knew me, he knew all the parties that would be involved in dealing with this disaster, so I just hired him on the spot and said, let's go. By the way, I should say here that Skippy is 6'2", about 300 pounds. Very nice guy, laughed a lot, was funny, easy to be around. Once in the set of Tommy Boy, he'd been caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I felt bad for him. Chris and I were doing a scene where we had to wait outside of a house before going in to see what Rob Lowe and Bo Derek. Unbeknownst to me, Chris was pissed at me that morning, because the night before when we landed in Toronto, Chris had said he was sick and he was going to bed. So I called Rob Lowe and asked him if he wanted to go get a beer at the hotel, whatever. I found out later Chris did not like this. Why? Because I was sort of his wife. I mean, we were very close back then, and it was definitely weird because he had like a possession thing of his buddy. He was jealous. I called Rob and didn't tell him. This is classic Chris kookiness. So I'd seen this angry look on his face before. He'd kind of bite his lip and stare at me, and it sucked because it meant storms a-brewing. It was like looking at a grizzly. I could either run or try to make myself bigger. I should have known something was up because while we were sitting in makeup, Chris kept mumbling, "Where's precious Rob Lowe?" I'm like, "I think he's on the set." Then he'd start again like Travis Bickle or some shit. Everyone's eyes were darting around in makeup thinking, what's going on here? So a few minutes later, we're outside in the scene waiting for our cue to enter. It was freezing. I was sitting on the ground eating a tuna fish sandwich and he was staring at me, grinding his jaw, biting his lip, staring, staring. Eventually I go, can I help you, sir? Just to be a smartass, like anyone can picture. And he steps on my hand and sandwich, which were both on the ground. So picture me going to take a bite of my sandwich, and he steps on my fingers and my hand, and he weighs 1,000 pounds. I'm like, what the fuck? I popped up. This is the making myself bigger part. So I threw my Diet Coke on him. This was very basketball wives of me. Then he pushed me down 5 stairs. This was the textbook beginning of a street fight. Not a UFC fight, or actually any fight in history, but we were about to go at it. And by go at it, I mean, I'm about to lose very quickly to this Ronda Rousey motherfucker. And action, David and Chris. We hear that on the walkie-talkie. We both stare at each other for a beat and then casually walk into the scene. I had the first line. I just stared silent because too much was going through my head. Pete yelled, "What's David's line?" Script supervisor yells it. I just walk off the set. Pete was like, "Okay, I guess we're taking a 5. So I went to my trailer and Chris went to his. It was like Mariah Carey and Nicki Minaj. We were just two divas arguing about God knows what. It was mostly just exhaustion and getting on each other's nerves. Fred went to Chris and said, "You know, you can't go after Spade like that. He's fucking puncy. Plus, we have a movie to finish. I know you guys are tired, but he's smaller than you. If you're going to fight, you can't fight a guy that weighs 130. This made Chris even more mad because everyone wasn't taking his side. Not that anyone even knew why we were fighting. They didn't know this would turn out later to be the great tuna sandwich debacle of 1994. Chris calmly got up, looked out the window of his trailer, and saw Skippy walking by. There was a reason Skippy was brought into the story. He bolted out of the trailer, ran over, and tackled Skippy so hard for no reason other than he was pissed at me. And he was as big as Chris, and so he was taking Fred's advice. He hit this guy with a left shoulder form tackle like Strahan and took him down for absolutely no fucking reason. Then he kind of laughed and walked away. Skippy was obviously dumbfounded, but you can't talk back to number one on the call sheet. So he sort of chuckled and limped away. I'm sure the chuckling was more like, what the fuck? So Skippy was my assistant for about 3 years. That's a backstory, but it's still kind of a funny story. He did a great job. We got along. He did some improv comedy on the side. It was all good. Having an assistant means you now have someone who helps you do all the kind of shit work you used to do when you were struggling. When you have an assistant, it's a very odd thing because all my life, I was doing all these kind of jobs. I was a valet parker, I was a dishwasher, a busboy, a clothing store assistant, etc. Now I have someone working for me, so it's weird. I always wanted to be the cool boss because I had so many dicks in the past. Let's not take those last 8 words out of context. Eventually, some weird shit started to happen. Everything was normal for a long time. But when I saw some odd things, like NBC once asked if I wanted Dodger tickets, they would ask me that a lot because they were very cool. I told Skippy to say no, mostly because if you take something from the network, down the line they can come in and ask you for a favor in return. That's how things work. Sure enough, I got asked for a favor down the line. I said no. They go, "Hey, come on, we gave you all those Dodger tickets." I went to Skippy and I go, "Hey, we said no to those. Why are they saying that?" And he goes, "Oh, they told me I could use them if I wanted." All those Dodger tickets? But I'm still thinking, all right, don't be a dick about it. It's an honest mistake. Let the guy have some fun. The next thing is when I hear from Rebecca Romaine and Kid Rock, name drop alert, that my assistant had texted them. Now, they knew him, but he was just saying, "What's up?" It was nothing about I wanted to talk to them or meet up. Nothing business related. So that was weird. But the one that really hit me wrong was when he asked for a part in Joe Dirt. Oh, there's some applause. A few people in the back remember that one. Oh, thank you. I told him, yeah, I'd see if that's possible, but I don't have final say. Skippy was a big, funny, and likable guy, and he was doing improv and stuff, so I thought maybe he could do something. It wasn't totally out of the question. But when we were almost ready to film the movie, Adam Sandler called me to suggest Kevin Nealon for the part that I was going to give Skippy. Adam thought Neilan would be funny. I agreed. Kevin's great. He's always solid, and Adam's my boss. Easy enough. Bing, bang, boom. Now this is where it gets weird. I broke this news to Skippy, and he was disappointed. But then he quickly got pissed. Tell Adam the part's taken. Tell him no way you're doing that. I go, Skippy, I get that it sucks, but there's no way I'm telling Adam no on this. It's the one thing he asked for. He's the reason this movie's getting made. He never asked for anything. He likes you. He has no idea I held that part for you. I'll keep an eye out for something else. I should have paid more attention to this little exchange with Skippy, because that's not how an employee should talk to their boss, even if their boss is some dipshit like me. Cut to a few months later. I'm sitting with Skippy while editing Joe Dirt. He saw the scene with Neilan and goes, that's the scene Adam fucked me on. I would have nailed it. Now, there's a few problems with this. First of all, Neilan did great. Second of all, that attitude took me off guard. I said, Adam didn't fuck you on this, dude. Let it go. But then we ate dinner and he went home like usual. Around 5 a.m. that night, I had a gross feeling that someone was watching me while I slept. I look up to see a shadowy figure standing in the doorway of my bedroom, wearing a baseball hat and his arm behind his back. Needless to say, I'm scared shitless. It was Skippy. I didn't know this right then. I was out of it and I was weirded out. I mumbled, oh, shit, Skippy, what are you doing? And he goes, the alarm company called. It went off. Then he looked over at my bed to see if anyone else was there. Then he goes, so no one's here, you're all alone? And I start to stand up and I go, yeah. Hey, sorry they called you. I don't even think I turned the alarm on. Wham! Hits me in the face. I fell back. He punched me a few more times as I fell back on the bed. Then I rolled across the bed and popped up on my feet on the other side. When I looked down, I saw blood on the bed. I don't know what the hell's going on. It was like I was dreaming. I'm like, Skippy, what the fuck are you doing? It hadn't even sunk in yet that I was in a brawl and my nose and back were bleeding. He just stared at me blankly like a robot on a mission. He had a stun gun in the hand he'd been holding behind his back, and he was hitting me with it along with his other fist. The stun gun has like two sharp things on it where the electricity goes through, and that was cutting me. I didn't really realize this. I ran to the back door of my room, which opens to the yard, but I didn't have enough time to unlock it, so he grabbed me and threw me on the ground. The dude is big. I stood up in my vintage Conehead sleeveless t-shirt, and it came off in his hands. It's a funny movie, Coneheads. You know, parts were funny. So for a second there, we just stared at each other in disbelief. He's standing there with my t-shirt in his hands. I'm on the ground. I sprint away knowing I have one chance to escape, running out the garage door, into the driveway, and toward the front gate. Of course, with my security, I have to punch in a gate code to open the gate just to get out. So I'm suddenly in the Hotel California. I can never leave. Plus, I have no idea where I would even go, because at 5 a.m., even if I get the gate open, who's going to open their door to a crazy guy screaming? On top of this, Skippy's on my ass like a cheetah. This is very unlike him. He was really nimbly moving around. So I jump behind one of my old cars. It was a 69 GTX, FYI. Skippy's on the other side. I'm starting to get tired, but I'm also realizing this shit is for real. Picture getting up to pee in the middle of the night and how out of it you are, in this dreamy state where you're just like sort of woozy. Now I'm getting the shit kicked out of me and going, this is not a dream. This is real. And it kind of sucked. So I see him staring, crouched with his stun gun ready to fight. I say, fuck it. With my last energy, I run right at him, trying to surprise him. I hit him in the face and we go to the ground. By some miracle, I get into a position where I can punch him. I start wailing on his head with both fists. As I'm doing it, I realize this fucking hurts. It hurts me. I suddenly felt bad for these UFC guys. Hitting a head is literally like punching a rock. And I'm hitting my friend, which I don't want to do. One punch landed perfectly and he dropped the stun gun. I squirreled away and then hauled ass into the house. Slamming the door and trying to flip the deadbolt. Wham! He hits the door. This fucker was unstoppable. I fell on my back and gave up. I accepted my death. But, thank the Lordy, the deadbolt had closed just like a quarter inch to keep him out. I took my chance. Holy shit, I'm alive. I ran to my bedroom and slid under my bed, where I keep a loaded shotgun. Start the debate about guns here. The only other person that knew I had a loaded gun under my bed was who? Skippy. You guessed it. The police later told me their theory was his plan was to incapacitate me with the stun gun, go get my shotgun from under the bed, and kill us both. Fun theory. So I ran into the bathroom and locked the door. I look in the mirror and there I was in my just pajama bottoms. No shirt, bloody face, scratched arms and back. So I think, oh my God, this would be a great Instagram picture. I should Periscope this. No, that was 10 years too early, unfortunately. The pad of my big toe had caught on something and it was flopping around, bleeding. My nose was bleeding. My arm was cut. I feel my adrenaline dissipating, which is not good, but it's a good word. I realized I needed to go call the cops because if I passed out in my bathroom at 5 a.m., no one would find me. Then it occurred to me, I was going to have to go shoot my friend. Great friend, right? I'm not happy about this idea. I love guns, but I'm not into shooting people. I scream out, "Hey, dude, I'm coming out. I'm shooting your leg first. Then I'm shooting you in the fucking face. I'd get the fuck out of here." Real tough. I paused, then I kicked the door open. He was gone, thank God, because I would have hated to shoot someone. But I would have had to. Me or him. I peeped around the room. No Skip. I hobbled to the phone and called 911, and for some stupid reason, I did not rat him out. I told him some 6'2", 300-pound white guy came to my house and beat the shit out of me and to get over here, and then I'd be waiting in the alley behind my house. It's funny that this 911 call never got out. I think the cops did me a solid on that one. I went in the alley with my shotgun wandering around with blood on me. Eventually, the cops show up and motion for me to lay the gun down. I'm aiming my gun at a cop. He's aiming one at me, and he's like, "Put it down." I'm like, "All right. Okay." And he's like, "You're okay now. We have guys inside searching your house." I was at least coherent enough to say, "Well, you don't have to look everywhere. He's not in the drawers." I say this knowing I had some shit stashed in my drawers. Lo and behold, old Skip got away. The news vans were already pulling up to my house in another nightmare twist. So now I'm glad to be alive. I didn't want to blab to the media, though I probably should have and milked it. I have an actual problem going on here. Let's get some sympathy, Jesus. So the cops pulled Mark, my manager, aside and asked him why I was covering for someone. It was clear that I knew him because we were saying we talked, we didn't talk, and he had a key or whatever. I think I covered for Skippy because he'd been a close friend for such a long time. I also knew he's going to be toast if I ratted him out because now I lived, but he's going to go to jail for years. But when the detectives told my manager that they thought there was a gay sex thing going on there, oh, I sang like a canary. They found Skippy later that day parked on the street, very woozy and out of it. In his trunk, they found rope and duct tape. This was unsettling at best. They said he had taken 125 Tylenol PMs. Maybe he wasn't trying to kill himself, but when I take half of one of those, I'm out for about 10 hours. He had also left a few sketchy calls to his friends. Skippy went into the hospital because his liver shut down. I went to a hotel for a few days to chill the fuck out. The cops said I could press charges, but I never did. I asked them to get him psychiatric help so I could find out what the fuck actually happened. In my mind, drugs alone don't make you turn on a buddy like that. I couldn't make sense of it. He said he didn't remember anything. He told the cops. This guy was not a criminal mastermind. He just flipped out. Or he hated me. I guess I'll never know. People ask why I wouldn't press charges. Because he had a clean record and I was a bit worried. The cops told me he would probably get out of jail in 6 months. And I didn't want a Max Cady from Cape Fear thing happening where he bulks up and comes back to finish me off. So I tapped out and moved on. But ultimately, I did have to move to a new house because even after the blood came off the doors and the carpet, I was always scared to sleep in the old one. My therapist explained this to me. She said there was a term for it. It was called being a pussy. But I couldn't help it. So I moved out and got a new assistant, a girl who weighs 110 pounds. So I think I could take her for sure if shit went down. Well, 90% sure. Chapter 17, My First Hooker. I was with a hooker once. And it was a mistake. I mean, it was a mistake for me to sleep with her. I don't care about that. I just didn't know she was a hooker. I know you're rolling your eyes, but it's true. I was in Las Vegas, the first sign that something bad is about to happen, and I'm walking past a day club where there's a line to get in. So this very normal-looking, cute girl asked me for a photo. Side note, when someone asks me for a picture, I almost always say yes. 99% of the people who ask are very cool. The only drawbacks are those nervous, sweaty people, or they're really drunk, because shaking hands with them is like shaking hands with a sham wow. And the people are hot and stinky, and they put their arms around you. They press their stinking, sizzling pit into my shoulder, and it basically brands me, especially at the pool in Vegas. Hot, stinky pit branding on my bare shoulder, and it's so gross. All I can think of is Sizzler. So I take a few pictures with this girl, and then she invited me into the club, which was sort of just inviting me to stand in line with her. That seemed like a drag. Or maybe she wanted me to skip her to the front of the line of the club. I don't know. Either way, I let her off easy, telling her I was heading back to California. So she hit me up, giving me her digits, which is a really new term for phone number. Super new. Digits. Write it down. I told her, give me a call or I'd talk to her when I'm in Vegas. 2 weeks later, happened to be back in Vegas. At the time, I had a deal with one of the hotels on the Strip to perform 12 weekends a year. I had done the Mirage for years, Planet Hollywood, and also the Venetian. I loved all these spots, and I had great gigs there, a lot of fun shows. I won't say which hotel this was, because if word leaked out that there was a hooker scene in a hotel in Vegas, all hell would break loose. Vegas would shut down tomorrow. I don't want that. Being the gentleman that I am, I texted the young lady who I'm about to squire, and I said, do you remember me? You want to meet for a drink or come to my shitty show? She was like, what are you doing right now? This seemed a bit unorthodox because most of my courting happens at night, and this was the middle of the day. Daytime is odd, stiff. I don't day drink, so there's not much to say or do, especially in Vegas, unless she wants to take a romantic stroll down to Glitter Gulch or slots of fun in 110-degree heat. But I didn't even know her, so I was like, I'm golfing with my idiot friends. In fairness, all my friends are idiots. I definitely need new friends, in a side note. Anyway, she answers back, what about before the show? Well, I usually get ready in the room. This was the most basic, uncreative answer, but I didn't know what was going on. She goes, maybe I'll just come by the room before. I go, okay, I sort of get what's going on, do I? I was stoked, though. Clearly, this chick was into me. Maybe she wanted a hot beef injection before the show. Hi, Mom, isn't this a good book? Could it be this easy? I mean, I'd usually take this more seriously, but she's setting the casual tone. She was slutty, and I didn't see a big future with her, so I said, nah, no problem. If she wanted to rally, I'm all for it. Who am I to kill this off? So I finished my dumb golf, head back to the hotel. Knock, knock, there she is at the door. Now I'm nervous because I have zero booze in me. I was noticeably weirded out because I had no idea what to do next. Does she just want to talk? Do I make a move? Does she want to be buddies? Do I talk about Joe Dirt? Does she want me to leave a funny message on her friend's voicemail? I get that a lot, more than you think. But no, she just sauntered in and looked out the window. Nice view, she said, not really caring. Oh, that old 50-mile gorgeous view? I joked weakly. She barely registered that I had spoken, and then she started to strip, folding her clothes into a neat little pile. Next, she took off her rings. Oh, yeah. Shit's going down. Places, everyone! When a chick takes her rings off, you know there's going to be some dick-grabbing happening. Then she dropped the bomb. So, it's 800 up front. Immediately, I freaked out. She was a cop. I did not know what to do. I sort of wanted to go through with it anyway because I didn't want to look like a pussy and I wanted to get laid. Hi, Grandma. Are you hearing this? You know what I mean, guys? Who's with me? So my mind is swirling. What if I hand her the money and she slaps cuffs on me? What if it's a trick and she takes the dough and then she goes and blabs to the tabs? Don't be a tab blabber. Listen, my dick doesn't shoot up north in record time on a normal night, if you get my drift, so this confusion didn't help. But finally we got down to a little action Jackson. We start to go at it, and to be honest, girls don't like when I fuck them anyway, but this girl really couldn't stand it because it was all biz. And she, of course, makes me wear this rubber she gives me that's made of Gore-Tex or something that hookers make in a hooker supply factory, so I had literally zero feeling in my dick. It's not good when both parties say, is it in, at the same time. Jinx! But seriously, I can tell she's just going through the motions. Oh, babe, so hot. She sounded like a Kardashian. Oh, my God, babe. That's so good. I like it. Like a robot. Like a hooker robot. Missionary, doggy, missionary. Then she goes, come for me, babe. Which translates to, let's wrap this up, old man. I gotta be at the Bellagio in 20. So to top off this nightmare, this call girl actually takes a call during the boning, which is, I don't know where that falls in the book of etiquette, but my boner left the building, so to speak. Very rude. So that was that. Dear Abby would have had a field day with her behavior. So that's my hooker story. She wasn't a cop. But now there's another chick out there who thinks I don't fuck good. Great!